As this is a service of remembrance, we'll begin by lighting our chalice. May the light we now kindle inspire us to use our powers to heal and not to harm, to help and not to hinder, to bless and not to curse, to serve you, Spirit of Freedom.
I'd like to welcome everybody here and be mindful this is a service of remembrance, and not just for the people that have recently died in the active work and in the coal mines and on the oil rigs, and certainly that touches our hearts, but to recognize that this day of remembrance is a day set aside for us to remember all the workers who have died in the line of their duties at work, and also a day of remembrance for those who have died to make the conditions for the working people better. We have gathered here today to remember and honor working people who have lost their lives contributing to the foundation of our society. Workers. The convenience store clerk who, thank God, is there at 3 a.m. The firefighter who reaches into death and pulls you out to life. The janitors, the trash collectors, the police, the teachers, those who punch a time clock and surrender their freedom for a time so that their families can eat and have a home. The worker who endures good management and oppressive management. The worker who makes things they may never have enough money to buy, who watches life go by so that their children can have opportunities that they never had. The working person who descends into the earth, knowing safety has taken a back seat to profit, yet still punches the clock and surrenders to risk. It has not been easy for the workers of our great nation. Many gave their lives during the Second Civil War in the early 20th century. Many citizens do not know of that Second Civil War, where workers went to the streets to form unions and demand rights, the rights of being human, the right to reasonable work hours, to have safe working conditions, the right to bargain, pensions, health care, representation for grievances. Many died in the streets. Many in the very tents in which they lived, them and their families, the state and the company bringing down a hammer, bringing it down with a mighty force. However, they met an unexpected force. The Pinkertons, the state, the companies, that hammer landed on an anvil that would not give. The worker. When one died, another stood. When men were stymied, women came forth. When that oppressive hammer of tyranny, did not break the force and the spirit of that anvil, the worker. The union held and the middle class was born. Not just to bread did we strive, but for bread and roses. The working person's life began to know freedom, to live in a space where she could breathe deeply and the air was clean. Let us never forget those people who gave their lives and lost their lives so we can know the experience in this life of bread and roses. Now, Warren Lindquist will come up and speak for a bit and then introduce our next speakers.
At my age, I thought you used megaphones. My name is Warren Lundquist. If I was at an AFL-CIO convention, I would say Warren Lundquist, Local 687 Service Employees Union. That was the last union I was in. I was in the letter carriers, the bartenders, the service employees, and the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies. Those are the organizations I've been in. When we're talking about worker safety, I was a compliance officer at one time for the Idaho Department of Labor, an industrial safety compliance officer and wage and hour compliance officer. Public employees in the state and local government aren't covered by OSHA. Some states adopted the OSHA regulations for their employees, and that's why I enforced. I was also the asbestos expert for the state of Idaho, and I'm just going to briefly tell you about three happenings. Once I got appointed there, I go out and I look. I go to a school in Council, Idaho. I'm asking about their asbestos. They said, oh, we had it all removed. I says, what contractor did you use? Oh, we didn't. We used two of our students who worked the summer doing it. I says, what kind of respirators and stuff? Oh, they didn't use anything. The next one, I go to Riggins High School. They got a metal shop. I'm talking to the teacher. He says, oh, yeah, this is all sheet asbestos. I said, well, that's good. That's not fibrous. He goes, oh, yeah, but we sawed it. In fact, he says, the dust was so thick that we could not see across the room. And all these students, I mean, if they're still alive now, it's going to surprise me. The third one was in a state capitol. I'm talking there. They removed the asbestos, like on this side of the room, left the workers working here, women, clericals. And here all these guys are wearing respirators and, you know, all this protection. And these people are, and I says, didn't it bother you? Well, no, why should it? Management wouldn't do anything bad to us, you know. And I know, you know, in 20 or 30 years, they're going to be dead. Unless they ingest it. If you ingest asbestos, you're going to die in 18 months. And then they have an operable tumor. Now we talk. The latest statistics that I could find was for the 2008, we had 1,158,870 industrial accidents where a person lost work. That was just injuries. On fatalities, we had 5,071 in the United States in 2008. When OSHA was brought in, it was brought in under Nixon. Nixon hated it, but he didn't veto it. He didn't think he'd get away with vetoing it, but he got to enforce it. So instead of the inspectors going out, now I was a state inspector, so I wasn't included in this, but the federal inspectors, instead of going out where the injuries and the accidents, they were doing height of light switches, doorknobs, and split toilet seats. Basically, what they wanted to do is destroy OSHA by public opinion, by just going after the chicken stuff, you know? Now, if you want to have safety, you need to move to Sweden. At one time in Sweden, they had a law that the union steward could close down anything that was unsafe, and everybody got paid till it was fixed. They didn't think that was too fair. So they changed it. Any worker in Sweden can close anything down that's unsafe, and everybody gets paid till it's fixed. Now there's an incentive for safety, you know? Love it. I'll give you an example between OSHA. They had a chemical plant, an acid spill. A worker got dissolved. The company was fined $185,000. Then the chemicals went in the river, and the EPA fined them $10 million for the dead fish. $185,000 for the dead worker, $10 million for the dead fish. If you, like in World War II, we lost, killed or injured, a little over a million. That's both killed and injured. 1941 to 1945. During the same amount of time in the United States, we had over 11 million workers killed or injured. 11 times more than were killed in combat during the same period of time, you know. So you're just looking at, you know, how hazardous your job is. 1934 to 1936, 84 workers just died on picket lines. Just walking with a sign, and the Pinkertons, or the National Guard, or the U.S. Army, because they called them out to break strikes, kill them. If you're looking at early actions in history, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. This was a building, multi-story building, in New York City. And this happened in March 25th, 1911. These were seamstresses. The building caught on fire. They headed for the exits. Oh, all the exits were locked. Management was afraid those workers would sneak out and take a break. So they had 147 women died, either were burned to death, or the ones that didn't want to face the fire jumped out of the windows and died. But 147 workers died just because they couldn't get out of their workplace. Then you take Ludlow, Colorado. There's a book called Great Coalfield War, the Ludlow Massacre. This was George McGovern's thesis for college. He wrote this book. But what happened there is they went out on strike, United Mine Workers. They had to move out of their company housing. They put up a tent city. The National Guard came in, set the tents on fire, and machine gunned them. They had 13 women and children, and 5 men died there. The tragic part about this strike was what they were striking for were all laws in the state of Colorado. They weren't enforced, but it was the law. That's all they were asking for, was the law to be enforced. This was a Rockefeller company that owned those mines. And, I mean, workers have died so often on so many things, you know. People talk about union violence. It's the unionists that die, you know. It's not, you know, the management and stuff like that. It's union violence. It's the worker that dies. I mean, they have spent fortunes to break unions. And that's a good way, though, to discourage somebody from being in a union. You just kill them. But that's all I am going to say now, but I thought I would tell you a little bit about the history of like OSHA and some of the actions and stuff we had. And if anybody wants to look at these figures that I got from 2008, it lists all the reasons. You know, like transportation instances, 2,053 died. Homicides, that must be a Circle K, right? 517. And our next speaker is Claudia Ponzi, who is the head of the Space Coast Labor Council. He is also an electrician, like forever. I think he was born one. Oh. You know how to do these fancy things.
Yeah, I'll stick them on.
Yeah, I never figured them out.
Thank you,
Warren. I can't even figure a touch tone phone.
Thank you, Warren.
You're welcome. Bell worker.
And thank you, Pastor, for opening up the house of God to the house of labor. We thank you for your gracious invitation to allow labor to say a few words. Certainly, the harvest is great, but the labors are few. And in the house of labor, we are thankful that you recognize that this community without labor ceased to exist. And once again, we thank you for opening up this for us, and we appreciate it. Warren told you a little history about labor, but I just want to speak a few words in regards to why we are actually here today. This is a memorial for workers, for those who gave their lives, for their families, their husbands, their wives, their children, and their friends. For those whose lives were spent doing what they must do to provide for their family, working for a living. Their time cut short by things that they didn't have to be. this memorial bring to our consciousness and our awareness to make the workplace safer for people like you and me, to make sure that our stories will never go untold, to always keep their memories from growing cold. We must remember the price that they had to pay. When we honor the men and women on Workers' Memorial Day, remember the dead, but we still must fight for the living. Those words were spoken by an International Associate of Machinist Worker in 1995 on April the 28th. Workers' Memorial Day, International Workers' Memorial Day, or International Commemorative Day for the Dead and Injured takes place annually around the world on April 28th. An International Day of Remembrance and Action for workers killed, disabled, injured, or made unwell by their work. Decades of struggles by workers and their unions have resulted in significant improvement in working conditions. But the toll of the workplace injuries, illness, and death remain enormous. Each year, thousands of workers are killed and millions more are injured because of their jobs. The unions of the American Federation of Labor remember these workers on April the 28th, Workers' Memorial Day. The first Workers' Memorial Day was observed in 1989. April the 28th was chosen because this was the anniversary of what Warren just spoke about, OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Every year, people in hundreds of community and work site recognize workers who have been killed and injured on the job. Each year, more than 2 million men and women die as a result of workplace-related accidents and diseases. Workers suffer approximately 270 million occupational accidents each year and fall victim to some 160 million incidents of work-related illness. Hazardous substances kill 440,000 workers annually. Asbestos claims 100,000 lives. One worker dies every 15 seconds nationwide. 6,000 workers die every day. More people die while at work than those fighting wars. In a world where an occupation, death, injuries, and illness at work are hidden away and taken for granted, Workers' Memorial Day is an opportunity to highlight the prevented nature of most workplace accidents and ill health, and to promote campaigns as this to inform our community. Although the 28th of April is used as a focal point for remembrance of Memorial Day, it was started by the Canadian Union in 1984. The Canadian Labor Congress declared an annual day of remembrance in 1985 on April the 28th, which is the anniversary of the Workers' Compensation Act. Workers' Memorial Day is recognized as a nationwide in many countries, including Argentina, Bermuda, Brazil, Canada, Dominican Republic, Panama, Peru, Taiwan, and Portland. On the first day of every month, every September, we celebrate Labor Day. That's a day we have as a holiday to recognize the strides that labor has made to society, to remember the workforce of America. how important it is for this great nation of ours and the contribution we made to make this country the greatest in the world. On April 28, we observe Workers' Memorial Day. This is a day that goes unnoticed by many Americans, and it should never be forgotten. That's a day we remember our brothers and sisters who have died or who were injured because of workplace-related hazards. I ask all of you to stop and think for one moment of someone you know that died or suffered an injury on the job, a teacher who went to work then never returned, a firefighter who went in the fire to never come out, a police officer who got killed on duty. I can recall one such person. His name was Al. Al and I worked together for many years, 1977. I was a technician, and Al was a cook. We worked on the ships together. In the shipyards, we normally went in to redo the ships. Because Al was a cook and I was a technician, I was fortunate enough to be able to stay in hotels during the refurbishing of the ships. Al was exposed to asbestos. At 11 o'clock this morning, I put to rest my friend Al. So this day holds a close to my heart, Worker Memorial. I lost a good friend. But his death will not go unnoticed. For as long as I have breath in this body, I will continue to promote Workers' Memorial Day and to bring a focal point on the need that the community, faith-based community, and labor needs to work together in order to gain our voice in society. And with that, I'd like to introduce to you some of the bravest people that I've ever met, the firefighters. Dave, would you come forth, please? And I thank you for coming and sharing your story with the people. And I thank each of you for coming. And I'm hopeful that this relationship will continue to grow as we grow. Thank you.
Thank you for having me here today. I am Dave Ginsburg. I am a lieutenant with Palm Bay Fire Rescue, and I am also the president of Local 2446 of the International Association of Firefighters, representing the 120 bargaining unit members of the Palm Bay Fire Department. This is the first time I became aware of Workers' Memorial Day. I'm happy to be here. Firefighters see workers injured or worse from both sides. Firefighters respond to you. We respond to your colleagues and your families, to your workplace accidents that cause injury and death to you and your colleagues. We work to treat your injuries, and we see the devastation on your faces as we attempt to mitigate a situation that most likely could have been prevented. And we see our own workplace injuries as we respond to you. Firefighters are injured and killed in workplace accidents on a regular basis. Firefighters who work feverishly to free trapped workers get injured themselves. They suffer heart attacks on the job and die on the job. Central Florida has seen its fair share of deaths from job-related situations, to include Palm Bay. Firefighters and other rescue workers are injured and killed while training. A few years ago in Central Florida, two firefighters were killed in a training accident on a live burn structure fire, and another was killed while training for brush and wildland firefighting. I researched Workers' Memorial Day and came upon an industrial accident in Georgia a few years ago at the Imperial Sugar Company. A dust explosion occurred, killing 13 people. It was a preventable accident, had certain OSHA requirements been followed by the company, but they weren't, and people died. I read about an accident in California on the Golden Gate Bridge a few years ago when a worker fell to his death due to insufficient scaffolding, which, if certain regulations had been followed, it would have been prevented, but it wasn't, and somebody died. Most recently, 28 miners died in a coal mine in West Virginia at the hands of a company with known and admitted violations of safety, and yet again, just 2 days ago in Kentucky, two more miners died, and again at the hands of a company with known safety violations. All of these accidents were preventable, had violations been corrected, but they weren't, and people died. 11 dead in an oil rig explosion in the Gulf at the hands of a company who has consistently opposed federal safety regulations. Calling for self-regulation, 11 dead in what will most likely be determined as a preventable accident. And further, because of a failed safety valve to prevent the uncontrolled flow of oil, we're facing an as yet to be determined environmental disaster, not only along the Gulf, but possibly right here on the Space Coast early next week. Closer to home, local firefighters have responded to construction accidents of all kinds that have injured many local workers. Some were accidents, and accidents do happen, but others were not. In many cases, if just one or two safety procedures had been enforced or followed, the injuries could have been prevented. Some of our workplace situations also involved a convenience store worker who was injured during the act of a crime. Local industrial accidents that have injured and killed workers right here in Central Florida. Again, many safety violations, had they been followed, these accidents would have been prevented. Firefighters and other rescue workers are not immune to injury or death. A few years ago, in Charleston, South Carolina, 9 firefighters were killed in the worst single case of firefighter death since 9/11. In a furniture store fire where in a state that does not believe in collective bargaining and in a state that does not believe in working with or even recognizing organized labor, in a city where its fire chief did not employ modern firefighting techniques, in a city that did not follow modern firefighter procedures and training methods, in a city where its fire union was helpless to change the way it had been for decades because it had a chief that believed that if it worked in 1970, then by God it will work now. And he also said that nobody, especially a union local, tells us how to do it here in Charleston. 9 firefighters were killed on that day at a very preventable accident. And at the funeral service for those 9 firefighters in Charleston, our union delegation from Washington, D.C., to include our international's president, they were not only invited into the church, but they were not even recognized by the city as being present. I visited that site last year. It's now a vacant lot. It's fenced off and it's cared for by members of the Charleston IAFF local. 9 flags are laid out in a vacant fenced lot with flowers by each one, indicated where each of the 9 were found in the building which once stood on the lot. Through the persistence of the International Association of Firefighters and the South Carolina Firefighters Association, the unions in South Carolina did bring change, and now more than 2 years later, the chief is gone, removed and replaced by a modern-day thinker who believes in modern-day techniques, training, and safety. A department is now on the crossroads of changing from yesterday to today with the help and guidance of our unions. But injuries and deaths still occur throughout our nation. Millions of American workers are injured each year in workplace accidents, and thousands are killed. 80,100 firefighter injuries were reported in 2008, which is the most recent full year the records are currently available, and that is a decrease of 4% from 2007. Leading cause of firefighter injuries are strains and sprains, with the back being the primary injury site. Many firefighters are forced into earlier disability retirements due to this type of an injury, yet our community is currently seeking us to significantly reduce our early and disability retirement benefit. The National Fire Administration, backed by the International Association of Firefighters, reports 118 firefighter deaths in 2008. The leading cause of firefighter deaths is heart attack, followed by work performed at the scene of an emergency, such as collapse of a building, being trapped or entangled, and then closely followed by accidents involving our fire apparatus responding to or returning from an incident. Firefighters enter situations in which they have no idea what to expect. We enter situations where a typical single-family home ends up being a drug lab. There's also no telling what the average homeowner keeps in his garage. The garage of the average, everyday, law-abiding American family can be a disaster to a firefighter when the gallons of old, unused paint mixed with the 10-gallon gas can and the propane tank from the barbecue grill all become involved in a fire. That's one of the inherent dangers that a firefighter accepts, and we accept those dangers. But it's the dangers like those of Charleston, South Carolina, or that West Virginia coal mine that we as American workers cannot stand and should not accept. Firefighters are always looking for safer ways to do the job, safer ways to protect you, and work towards a reduction of our injuries and deaths. We're constantly working with local, state, and federal elected officials to approve safer methods, safer procedures, safer and more efficient equipment and apparatus, and you should as well. As workers, we all should be aware of what is safe and what is not. We should all be thinking of how to perform the task at hand while reducing the possibility of injuries and deaths to ourselves and to our colleagues. We should speak up to our employers if safety issues are being ignored by their company. We should speak up to our own colleagues if they are ignoring a safety procedure as a means of getting something done quicker. Unfortunately, some of our workplace injuries do occur as a result of some of our own people who skip over something, fail to inspect something properly, or just do it quicker to get it done. And people are injured and killed as a result. You should contact your elected officials and demand support for the Protecting America Workers Act. It's legislation that is designed to strengthen and update OSHA for the first time since its 1970 inception date. And before I close, I would like to mention and remember the first and thankfully the only Palm Bay firefighter who has died as a result of his job duties, Captain Mike Marcinic, who died of a heart attack in May of 2007. My thoughts are with him today, and I remember him fondly. I thank you for inviting me here today and allowing me to speak on my very first Workers' Memorial Day speech. Please stay safe, not only in the workplace, but always, and God bless you.
Just thought I'd briefly mention that there are three major faith traditions that are anchored in the Exodus story in the Torah, the Old Testament, and they're anchored in the how God delivered God's people from suffering, and you hear a lot of sermons wrapped around that concept, but what you don't hear is God was responding to the oppressive labor conditions that were put upon the workers of that nation of Egypt, the Jewish people. And when they cried because of their poor labor conditions, God responded and sent Moses. The act of deliverance was into better working conditions. So sometimes we don't hear from our faith communities the very foundation from which our communities were born. I have the pleasure now of introducing David Wilson, not only because of his work with the union and the Steelworkers Union, but also my father, and I asked him to send me a bio, which I did not get, so now I'm going to be dependent upon my memory, and the memories of one's father being spoken publicly is kind of a risk, I would think. Maybe you should have got me in a bio, Dad. But I just want to say anything I say, let me know if I've got it right or not, because I may not get it right. My father was a president of a union local in Baltimore, 2610 or 2609, for 20 years, before becoming the district director of District 11 Steelworkers Union, which covered Maryland to Kentucky. And I know that he has done bargaining and contract in Japan, Canada, Mexico, and your own district. And so he's been around the world to see and look at the labor conditions from around the world. I also know that he is responsible for legislation for not the black lung, but the red lung. Is that what they call that, the steel workers? in which he realized that these were healthy young people going into the steel working steel plants, but many of them were dying 2 or 3 years after their retirement, and asked the question, well, how come if they're healthy going in, they're dying at 65, 67 coming out, not living to 80? And in pursuing that, realized that they were acquiring this lung disease and they were dying, and actually got legislation passed, and so that these families and these people got compensation for that, which is happening still to today. He's a man that has fought for laborers since 1950, where you started in the union? A long time. And I just tell you one of the stories about my father, and also I think it will sum up kind of the attitude of our nation toward workers and working class, that much of our nation would like workers and the working class to be invisible, not to be seen, not to have a voice, not to take a fair share of the plenty and bounty of our land so that workers can have small boats in their driveways and go fishing, so that we can have the roses, the good things of life, not just the bread of life, would like us to be invisible. And then this story goes, there's a coal steel mill, was this in West Virginia?
Maryland.
In Maryland, that I know that, have my father's word for it, so I know it's true, that he was probably primarily responsible for having this plant built with the concessions he made as the district director. And that when they first took this picture, my father was in the picture they took. So if you look at the original, you would see him. But when you look at the publication where the union person who was responsible for this coal plant, if you look at the publication to hunt for his picture, it's not to be found. It's right here. Invisible. Not the credit given to the union who was instrumental for that. And so I think today, and we can see some of the difficulties we have in the attendance here, although I'm grateful for what's here, is that the attention to the worker and working class, it's not a focal point. Workers' Memorial Day did not get a lot of attention on Fox News or MSNBC or CNN. But if we work today and make this today the beginning of something where we pay attention to Workers' Memorial Day and Labor Day, maybe in our community we can do that. So with that, I am proud to say, Dad, David Wilson.
Thank you. Probably, yeah. I think that would be a good idea.
Put it in your, let me get it so it doesn't scratch on your jacket.
I might want to take my jacket off.
You might want to take your jacket off.
Put it on the pepper pot. Okay. Thank you, Greg. You're pretty accurate there. Few inaccuracies, but it doesn't make any difference, really, in the ultimate end of it. I think Workers' Memorial Day, it means different things to different people. It's certainly not a national holiday. It's a holiday, or it's a memorial day that has been, find its generation in the labor movement.
There you go.
Take it off. How's that? Is that better?
Yeah.
And it means different things to different people. Actually, my association with it was that in the Steelworkers Union, when you get elected to be district director, you become part of the executive board. And the people who negotiate contracts are the executive board members. I was assigned to the secretary of the negotiation committee for the Bethlehem Steel Corporation. And I guess to keep me out of trouble, they assigned me to negotiate the safety section of the contract. And that's where, it was 1989, and that's where Workers' Memorial Day came into the steelworkers. Actually, I copied it from Canada. They had it before us. And I wanted to bring to the company's attention the fact that there was some worth to the people who had already died in the product of their in the effort to produce the steel. Now, the beauty of our negotiations was we had 10 major steel companies under contract. And instead of negotiating each one by each one and putting one against the other, they all agreed that they would go under what they called a master contract. And the company that negotiated first, the rest of them would follow that pattern. It's called pattern bargaining. Well, that year, Bethlehem was first. So when I got the extra holiday, of course it was paid, intended to be a day off, but if they made you work, you got double time and a half. That was the attention getter for the company. Every other steel company had to follow suit. So all steel workers, it was over 200,000 of them at that point in time, they all got in their contracts workers' Memorial Day. So by negotiating with one company, we covered everybody. We also got in that contract the right to refuse work. We call it Article 14.3. So if something unsafe, you can shut the place down. And they still do that today. Had they had this coal mine disaster, if they'd been unionized in Virginia, safety person would have shut that mine down, and they wouldn't have died. Don't ask me why Virginians resist unions. I've tried to organize unions in Virginia and have organized some. They're very, very difficult. They're very independent people. You don't tell me what to do. I ain't paying dues. I don't need a union. I'm a mountain man. Well, obviously they do need the unions, but that's the. So when I think of Memorial Day, I don't necessarily think of specific dead people. I think of how we got where we got to, and what road we had to travel to get there, and obstacles we had to overcome. Actually, U.S. Labor Department was created in 1913 by President Taft. Unfortunately, at that time, to organize a union, you came under the antitrust law as a violation. So they put you in jail if you organized. So having a labor department wasn't all that worthwhile to the working people. But it did get a start. And then along came the Clayton Act, which exempted unions from union organizers from being a violation of the antitrust law. And that started organizations. And then in 1936, we haven't been around that long, as you can see. In 1936, the National Labor Relations Act, or the Wagner Act, came into being, and which created certain rights to workers. Each one of these, it's interesting to follow the political trail here, too, because each one of these things for workers was challenged by the Republican in the Supreme Court by saying they were unconstitutional. Eventually, the Supreme Court ruled that they were constitutional, so it took about a year and a half, 2 years after the laws were passed for us to be able to work with them. So, in 1937, the AFL-CIO, the CIO, which was the non-craft section of the union movement, the steel workers became a part of that. John L. Lewis, who was head of the mine workers, assigned Walter Reuther to be the head of the steel workers division, and the steel workers were born in 1937. and eventually got most major steel companies into the family of steel worker of the union. The initially, I joined the union in 1951 and got active. And initially, we weren't concerned about safety. We were concerned about hours of work, wages, and working conditions, and scheduling, and vacations, and basic stuff. We kind of got that under control, and we started looking at safety. By that time, I had been elected to be recording secretary of the local. And the local at that point had 10,000 members, so it was a significant size local. And we had a clause in our contract. We had a benefit in our contract which gave widows a $500 payment when their husbands died. But there was a caveat to that, and that was that if the person died prior to being 55 years of age, the benefit wasn't paid to the widow. Don't ask me where that came from. I guess it was just negotiated that way. So I started getting calls from widows. I didn't get my benefit. Well, how old was your husband? Well, he was 54. Well, sorry about that. Don't qualify. So we changed that in the contract. But because of that experience, I started wondering why steelworkers were dying so young. And I started doing what they call a mortality study. I went back 10 years, and I got the name of everybody who had died and the date they died in the previous 10 years. And we went to the health department, the Bureau of Vital Statistics, and we researched every death certificate. So then we found out what they died of and how old they were. What that mortality study showed there was that the average steel worker died at age 62 and a half. Well, when you think about the fact when they started, they were 19, and they had to be in good physical shape. You had a tough physical before you could go to work. So when you take a group of healthy 19-year-olds and look at how long they should live, you're talking 80, 90, normal. So what makes them die at age 62 and a half? So we did the mortality study. We got the cause of death. We had like a 60% excess over the general public. And we used Baltimore City as the comparative group. Baltimore City is a high cancer place because of the chemical companies that were there. So, with all this excess, then I started to do what they call a morbidity study. That is, people are still alive and I'm looking at them to see what's wrong with them. So I worked out a form to ask you what your problems are, and then I put questions there like, have you got your teeth? You know, how are your eyes? Do you have problem breathing? How's your sex life? Stuff like that. Now I recall one guy came into the office, and I'm going down the list, and I said, he was 44 years old. I said, how's your sex life? Oh, fine, I don't have any problems. I said, well, what do you mean by that? He said, well, I haven't had sex for like 4 or 5 years, so I don't have any problems. And that's the way the mind works. Well, the fact is, he'd been exposed to lead and had a high level of lead in his blood. And one of the symptoms of that is you lose your libido. But he hadn't connected it to the job. So that showed us specific areas where we had specific problems. If you worked in a pickler with sulfuric acid, you didn't have any teeth. Everybody in the pickler doesn't have any teeth. They're all rotted out because the acid ate the enamel off the teeth. The ventilation wasn't adequate. So now you got a whole bunch of people without teeth. Also, there's a very high percentage of throat cancer in those kind of areas where you're exposed to acids. All of this was covered up, and I'm saying by a conspiracy between the medical community and the corporate community. For example, in 1939, in England and Europe, they recognized asbestos as causing asbestosis, not necessarily lung cancer. That came later. But it wasn't until 1958 that the United States recognized that asbestos might be a problem. So in 1958, the company looked at their overall operation and decided that certain people were exposed to asbestos. One group was bricklayers. Now, a bricklayer in a steel mill is the guy that goes into an open hearth furnace, rips the lining out, which is fiberglass brick, to prevent the metal from melting when he put the molten metal in there. Every tenth row of that brick is a spacer of asbestos, so that when it gets up to 2,000 degrees, the bricks don't just, they heat and they expand and they contract, and they just don't fall out. So every tenth row is a row of asbestos. Now, over a period of 3 or 4 months, you have to reline that furnace. Now, to reline that furnace, you have to take the old brick out, that which has not fallen out. So the bricklayers get in there and they bust all that brick out, cart it out. In the process, they make all this fine dust from the asbestos because they breathe it in. Those days, they didn't give them masks or anything. I mean, we're strong steel workers. It's not a cookie factory. You know, you got to put up with a little bit of crap once in a while. That was the mentality. So I took a look at the bricklayers. There's 15 of them in this particular gang. 7 of them had had lungs removed. 3 of them had mesothelioma. And the rest of them were, you know, okay. So I talked to the one, one of them died, and I called the widow and I talked to her. And I said, well, how did you know he was sick? Oh, yeah, he'd been off for 6 months. He just went back to work. He died on the doorstep when he came back home from work that day. Okay. Did you know what was wrong with him? No, the doctors never told us. So I said, okay. And then I found out he was in a hospital called City Hospital. I went to City Hospital, dressed up in my tie and coat. And I said, I came here for Mr. Jones's medical records. He looked at me and the tie and the coat will get you most anywhere. And they said, are you from Bethlehem Steel? I said, yes, I am. They hand me the whole packet. This is stuff that you can't get because they always claimed it was privileged information and all that kind of crap. So I got it and I got all the x-rays, and you could put the x-rays up and anybody in this room could, if I pointed it out to you, could tell this guy has got mesothelioma, the pleural lining of your, that separates your intestines from your vital organs. But once cancer gets in there and eats that away, you're a dead duck. There's nothing they can do for you. And it shows up on the x-ray as being a big white blur. I mean, it's just nothing there. So, armed with that, I go to OSHA, I file a complaint against the company. And once you do that and they determine there's cause for a complaint and they process it, their lawyers become your advocate. So you can't get your own lawyer in there to say exactly what you want, but their lawyers do the work. And they were reasonably good. Now, with 1958, when they recognized asbestos as a problem, the company gave every one of these workers a pulmonary function test every year. That was a requirement. They never told any one of them that they had a problem. Question, did they know they had a problem? So what we get, they had a grade B radiologist assigned to look at these x-rays. His name was Dr. Franz. And he gets on the witness stand, and our lawyer says, "Did you give these folks x-rays?" "Yes, I did." "Did you know that they had cancer?" "Yes, I did." "Did you tell them?" "I told my patient," was his exact words. "Well, who was your patient?" "Bethlehem Steel Company. They paid me, they're my patient, I gave them the information. What they do with it is their business." Now, what the company hoped, and what they had been getting away with for years, is these guys would simply go home and die and not connect their death with the workplace. And of course, once they go off sick for a few months, they stop talking to their co-workers, and bingo, the company is home free. Now, I wanted to put them in jail for that. That was my goal, that was my stated goal, and that was what I was pushing for. I didn't get it. They got fined heavily, then they were required to notify the people, and they were required to give them proper safety stuff and all that kind of stuff, but we didn't get anybody put in jail, which I thought we should have for that. And one of the reasons you don't get people put in jail when they ought to be there is the body politic. Corporations have an awful lot of influence over what goes on. Now, once again, in 1939, it was an obligation on the medical community, by law in the state of Maryland, to report, for doctors to report any case of industrial disease. In 1970, not one case of industrial disease had been reported. Keep in mind, we had steel mills, we had chemical plants, we had all kind of industry in the state of Maryland, which had produced toxic stuff and killed hundreds of people, but not one case of industrial disease had been reported. Johns Hopkins Hospital, which is a big institution that dealt with thousands of people, had not reported one case of industrial disease, even though I just explained to you all these people with mesothelioma and cancer and nothing. So there had to be a conspiracy between the medical community and the corporations to keep their mouths shut. They just didn't report it. So if you don't report it, it's not there. So we started digging around and we started making a lot of noise. And it's kind of funny. We got the Washington Post is a paper that I think every politician reads first thing in the morning when he get up. They look at that to see where they got their name in the paper. And we got next to some of the reporters, and we had headlines in those papers: "Death Stalks Bethlehem Steel Spires Point Plant," and we got attention, and we got meetings and congressional hearings, and things started to change. Now, one of the problems with the you can't talk about industrial disease without looking at the political situation, because that really, really dictates where we are. When we start out, Nixon signed the OSHA Act into law in 1972, right after the end of his first term of office, and before the start of his second term. He didn't do it with any intention of helping workers. He did it because it gave him a green bag where he could appoint a lot of his buddies to jobs that paid money. That was Nixon's strong point. But then along came President Ford, and then President Ford actually was a decent guy. He thought the law should be enforced, and he put a person in there, Lanman Ochter, who was a really good person and tried to enforce the laws and started the ball rolling. Then along came Jimmy Carter. Carter was another good, decent person. And He put a person by the name of Eula Bingham in as Assistant Secretary of Labor, who was responsible for enforcing OSHA, and she started putting ambient standards into place and working with it. Then along comes a fellow by the name of Ronald Reagan. He didn't change the law. He didn't try to change it. He gutted it by cutting off the financing. All of a sudden, he didn't have inspections. They got 100,000 places to inspect, so they only got 10 inspectors. Now, you can imagine how much inspecting they do. And they exempted many businesses from inspections. We used to be able to get the OSHA, and in the case of Maryland, it was MOSHA, which is Maryland Occupation Safety and Health. We used to get them to make unannounced inspection tours of plants. Well, under Reagan, they cut that out. They exempted all these plants from unannounced inspections. And they said, these are good companies. If they have a problem, they can send us a letter, and then we'll deal with it. Well, that's not going to happen. So he shut down field offices because he eliminated the budget. He got rid of people because he eliminated the budget. And under Reagan years, OSHA was pretty well non-existent. It was there, but non-functioning. Then along came Clinton, and we started getting activity again. Now we've got Obama. And I do believe that people in the Massa coal mining company are going to go to jail. I do believe that. I think because we've got that kind of political mentality running the country and in charge of the Justice Department, I do believe that we're finally going to see somebody put in jail. I tried a couple of times. I should have won. When you get a citation when somebody's died, it's a fatality. It's called a willful citation. And if they get the worst thing they can do is get a willful citation with a fatality. Now that carries a big fine. But if you get another willful citation with a penalty, that carries a jail sentence. So in the Sparrows Point plant, we had a continuous galvanizing line, which is a huge piece of equipment, maybe 10 times as big as this building. They got these giant rolls, steel runs through it. And a person got pulled into the roll and was crushed to death. Well, in the Burns Harbor plant, which is in Indiana, they had an exact same piece of equipment. Once again, they didn't have the guards on there they were supposed to have, and a guy gets pulled through the rolls. Well, that's all I wanted. Now I've got two willful citations, penalty, jail time. So I really went after him on that one. I thought I was going to get him. Once again, the people running the country didn't want to, because that was a federal violation, they didn't want to put him in jail. Of course, they got lots of fines, but fines didn't mean anything. And the odd thing is, if you get killed on the job, there's no penalty to the company at all, unless a person is married. Then the spouse gets $50,000, and if the spouse doesn't file a claim within 1 year, that's voided. They don't have to pay the $50,000. That's the law today. Now, where did workman's compensation come from? It used to be that if a steel worker got a leg or arm cut off or crippled, he would sit at the plant gates, and the workers would come and they would throw a few coins, and that's how they could survive, because there was nothing there. There was no workman's comp. There was no nothing. But then in the 30s, the lawyers came on the scene, and they started suing the companies when somebody got hurt. And they won a couple of cases. Well, that made the companies very nervous, because safety to them, up to that point, had been relatively no expense. They figure in the cost of safety. They add it to the cost of their product, and they get a freebie. So safety didn't mean anything to companies. They just paid for it up front. But when you started suing them, and they started collecting big benefits, All of a sudden, safety became a priority. Now, what do you do about that? It was the companies that fought for workmen's compensation, not the unions. It was the companies. They say, we'll give you $1,000 for an arm. We'll give you $2,000 for a leg. If you get killed, we'll give you $50,000, assuming you've got a better beneficiary. They put a price tag on all your body parts, fingers, hands. And what that did, by looking at a year's experience, it gave them a fixed cost once again. Build it into the cost of your product. Now it's another freebie. So it was the companies that pushed for workman's comp, and they got it. Now, it wasn't until some smart lawyer figured, the trade-off was that you're not allowed to sue the company. Workman's compensation protects the company from lawsuits. So if the company is negligent, you get pulled into that role because there's not a guard on it, you can't sue them because they didn't do it. So what some smart lawyer figured out, I can't sue the company, but I can sue the company that made that rule and didn't put a guard on it. All of a sudden, third-party lawsuits came into being. That's where the lawyers have been multimillionaires, because they sue now people. They sue people that make asbestos for people getting asbestosis. As they don't sue the companies that contaminate the people. They sue the companies that make the product that does the damage. And they managed to make that theory hold up in court. So that's what they're doing. That's where the lawyers and the people are making money, getting their compensation. But that's a... When I think of Workers' Memorial Day, I think of what we had to go through to get where we are today. We're a long way from home, of course. You see these companies are still defying the law, like the oil companies, like the mine companies. They defy the law because they've got the money to pay the fines. Money doesn't bother them. We got to start putting them in jail. And I do believe that some of these coal mine operators are going to be going to jail under Obama. But this will be the first time. Clinton didn't do it. Carter didn't do it. None of our so-called friends did it. Clinton was not a friend, as far as I'm concerned, of labor. We had a meeting with him on the executive board, and we had three issues. We had labor law reform. We had NAFTA. And what the hell was the other one? I don't know.
Healthcare.
Yeah, national healthcare. He looked us in the eye in that executive board meeting with a room, there was 12 of us in there. And he shook his finger in our faces and said, I will support every one of those issues if I become president. And he lied to us. He didn't support any of them. We put Hillary in charge of health care, knowing that she couldn't do it on her own. He encouraged and supported NAFTA, and you know, and never made any attempt to change labor laws to make it easier to organize. On all three issues which he promised to us he would take care of, he did nothing. I mean, if he'd attempted and tried to do it and failed, hey, that's okay. But he didn't. He went the opposite way on NAFTA. He really went the opposite way on health care, because he knew it would be an embarrassment to him because he couldn't do it. So he sticks his wife up front and lets her take the heat. So Clinton was a big disappointment. I'm not saying he was as bad as Reagan. I mean, Reagan was really bad. But, you know, the first thing Reagan did when he took office was to fire all the air traffic controllers because they went on strike for better working conditions. Fired them all. They never did get their jobs back. But he broke the union, and he set an example. Anyway, so what I think of in Workers' Memorial Day, I think of all those things that we did and all the things we've got to do. One thing that it does to you if you work in that arena, it makes you a political activist, because you realize that who you get elected does make a difference. And even though it may not be on a specific thing that you want at that point in time, overall it does make a big difference. And you know, hopefully we're going to see some changes in Tallahassee this year in the state of Florida, and we can make a difference in the state of Florida. I want to end by reading a paragraph out of I did a lot of testifying in front of Congress, and this was a statement I gave to Congress in 1978 when they had convened a group of management, a group of the union, to discuss whether or not standards were necessary to control cancer and other kind of problems, benzene, and whether they should have standards. Now, this is my closing statement to the Congress. So under the laws of our land, homicide is defined as the killing of a human being. There are three main categories: murder, manslaughter, and suicide. Under common law, manslaughter requires two elements to be present before criminal liability attaches. One is the legal duty of one person to another, company, worker, and the second is the knowledge of the danger. The Congress of the United States, in passing the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970, made it a legal duty under the General Duty Clause for employers to provide a safe and healthful place for employees to work. Some corporate spokesmen at these hearings have openly acknowledged the existence of occupational cancer. Moreover, when they make their economic and acceptable risk arguments, they at the same time admit that cancer induced by occupational exposure is a known fact, while argue that it must be accepted due to economic hardships that may be experienced by industry if forced to take measures to eliminate exposure to carcinogens. No law on our books says that economic considerations excuse manslaughter. Industry witnesses who have testified at these hearings have unwittingly established their own criminal liability. Perhaps hearings to deal with the problem of occupational cancer should be held at the Department of Justice, and what should be being decided is how long the corporate heads are going to spend in jail, not whether it will cost too much to stop the carnage in our workplace. That was what I did in 1978. I still haven't got anybody in jail, but I'm working on it. All right, thank you very much.
Can I add something you had? The current head of mine safety, for the first time in the history of this country, came out of the United Mine Workers Union. His name is Joe Maine, and at the age of 19, on his local, he was on the Health and Safety Committee.
That's part of the change in administration. He would never have been appointed under any Republican.
You know, we hear a lot of statistics, transitions in political figures, transitions in philosophies, depending who's in office and who is not in office. And again, what we don't really hear, I mean, we're hearing about it now because of the coal miners, but in general, what we don't really hear are the workers, that their lives are at stake depending upon who's in office and whether safety regulations are being funded and inspectors are being funded or not. And when a worker dies in California, what do I know? When a worker dies in Ohio, what do I know? And we don't have a workers-based communication system to help us understand what's happening nationwide. So workers remain invisible. Their deaths remain invisible unless we stop and pause to remember them. Our friends, family members, people that died unnecessarily died because of the sake of profit. Until we stop like we have today and remember them, they will remain invisible. And we will conclude the service with this reading. In the rising of the sun and in its going down, we will remember them. In the blowing of the wind and the chill of the winter, we will remember them. In the opening of the buds and in the rebirth of spring, we will remember them. In the rustling of leaves and in the beauty of autumn, we will remember them. In the beginning of the year and when it ends, we will remember them. When we are weary and in need of strength, we will remember them. When we are lost and sick at heart, we will remember them. When we have joys we yearn to share, we will remember them. When we punch the time clock, we will remember them. When we break for lunch, we will remember them. When we leave work to return to our families, we will remember their families. When the workday is done, we will remember their smiling faces. So as long as we live, they too shall live, for they are now part of us as we remember them. And we end this service in the words of that great worker's hero, Joe Hill, "Don't mourn, organize." This service is over.